Pleasure to be here to speak to soil scientists and also to have Ruth Patrick here. I knew Bill Patrick ever since I was a beginning scientist. In fact, my first professional scientific meeting was in New Orleans in 1969, and I remember it was very cold, so I wore warmer clothes this time so I would stay warm, but the weather's changed. So Bill Patrick has been an important inspiration for microbiologists as well as wetland scientists. And one of the interests to me and to other microbiologists is anaerobes. And of course, anaerobes are more favored in wetlands and wetland environments. And over my professional career, I've worked, as many of you know, in denitrification and dissimulatory nitrate reduction to ammonia, as well as the microbial degradation of pollutants, and the anaerobic degradation of aromatic rings and other compounds by interspecies hydrogen transfer. I began early working with anaerobes with Mike Klug at the Kellogg Biological Station in Michigan, because they have a series of lakes there. One, Wintergreen Lake, is a very eutrophic lake and a favorite for anaerobes. And so we began to study anaerobic processes in an ecosystem context there. While it was a lake, a shallow lake, it was on its way to be a wetland, as those lakes are in Michigan. So that is my, while I'm more microbiology-oriented than wetland-oriented, it's the anaerobes that are the common interest between people like me and wetland scientists. So I'm very pleased to be able to give a talk in recognition of Bill Patrick's work. I would also say that Bill Patrick was involved as an advisor and reviewer for the Kellogg Biological Station LTER grant. So in recent years, since the molecular technologies became more common and adapted to environmental use, and now the genomic technologies are also reaching that, I decided to, at this lecture, draw those techniques into aspects that would relate to understanding more about the microbial environment in wetlands as well as in other environments, and to give you a view of what is currently going on in microbial ecology as it draws on the genomic world. So my outline is first to talk what is known, what is the known and unknown microbial world, using genomes to understand what is a species. We talk about species in microbes, but what really is a species? What is the variation within species? And then some examples of intermediate redox specialists, because those are the kinds of organisms that are best selected in wetlands. So this is my view of the microbial world. It's a sphere, and it has three dimensions. It has breadth, which is the diversity of the microbial world. It has depth, which is our understanding of the insight into those microbes and how they function. And the third dimension is how that interfaces with the environment. So how the environment controls what microbes are there and what those microbes do. The breadth, I put numbers up of 10 to the 7th to 10 to the 23rd species. We have no idea how many microbial species in the world. I would think probably most people would say that 10 to the 7th is certainly a reasonable number now for microbial species. But you can also start at the other end too, and that's where the 10 to the 23rd comes from. I wouldn't want that quoted as a valid number, but there are about 10 to the 30th microbes on Earth. And then if you go from the high end and consider the different niches and so forth, then you can come up with that high end number. But the microbial world is much like astronomy, and I think that is our most related science. Because, as you can see, we have many objects with faint signals, and we view them from a distance, a considerable distance from their scale. We are methods dependent, just as astronomers are, in building a new instrument. But we learn much about the microbial world as new methods are developed. Most of what we are dealing with is unknown to science, just as it is in astronomy. However, we're guided by some general concepts. It's not that we're completely fishing for the unknown. We do understand some principles about how these organisms are patterned and function. It's becoming data analysis intensive. And as I'll show you in a moment, it will be even much more data intensive as we go forward. And the microbes, as well as the forces in space, are key to the system's existence, the universe's existence, as well as our Earth's existence. So the functional biogeochemical cycles are key to our existence on Earth. They're driven primarily by microbes. So we have a lot of similarity with astronomy. So look to astronomy for your new ideas. This is a very famous picture here. It's the first direct evidence of dark matter. And it comes by collision of two galaxies traveling at 28,000 miles per second. And that evidence of dark matter was observed. So how large is the microbial world? Well, what we know is from 16S sequences. And this is the growth with time in 16S sequences, environmental sequences, as well as those isolates. And I checked last night, and there are now 440,000 ribosomal sequences in the ribosomal database, which is the knowledge reference that the microbiologists have. But as I'll show you in a moment, we can now, in one run, get 400,000 sequences. So while this seems like a large number, it's nothing compared to what we will see shortly. This is an evaluation, then, of what we are learning about the microbial world, going to the question of how much we know or don't know. So this is taking fully characterized rhizobia sequences from 5,000 type strains, and how the expert defines those in terms of genus, family, order, and class. We do linkage clustering of those, and then we take the 50% point here as the guiding point for how many organisms that we have. So then we take the total sequences in the database and do this clustering, 1% for the species level, 3.5 at the genus level, which came from the previous class, family and order. So those are the total clusters we find in those 400,000 sequences. These are clusters with only environmental sequence, no culture. These have one isolate, and these have isolate with a described type strain. So this is the number of known species. This is the number in the environment, and this is the total. So you see, using this analysis method, we know 3,300, but we have evidence for at least 28,000. And if we go over here to higher, to the order level, we know 45, but there's at least an order of magnitude more orders that we have evidence for. But the big question is, are we reaching a discovery plateau? And this is this analysis, the number of sequences, species, genus, family, and order. This is the log scale, and this is time. And you can see all of these are continuing to grow in a logarithmic manner, even to the order level. So it emphasizes how much we don't know about the microbial world. And we know less about anaerobes than we do about other organisms. So where do those sequences in RDP come from? Well, 50% of them are organisms associated with animals, and a lot of them associated with us, humans. These are from soil, from marine waters, from sediments. These could be from wetlands also, and from other parts of the environment. But the point here is this information biased? Yes, it is, because I can assure you that half of the microbial world are not organisms associated with animals. It's biased because of funding, right? We're self-interested in organisms associated with us, so we spend more on organisms with us, not on the organisms in the rest of the world. So we have a biased sample. If we do a rank abundance curve, which is what ecologists do for a particular habitat, and these are the clusters here, and these are the numbers in any particular cluster at the different levels, you can see we get this skewed curve. So it shows we know a lot about a few groups, but little about other groups. So this pattern would not be predictive of Earth. So it also shows the bias in our information, that we know a lot about the few organisms that we can easily discover. Now, going to the next era, which is exploring the microbial world by pyrosequencing of the 16S gene. And some of you may be aware that the company 454 came up with a new sequencing technology, a high-throughput parallel sequencing. It then allows massively parallel sequencing to be done at cheaper cost. So we've begun to use this technology. So we can do massively parallel sequence and obtain 400,000 16S sequences in one run. So in 5 hours, we can equal the number of sequences in the ribosomal database done by all the scientists in the world over the last 20 years. So things are changing. We can divide those sequences into 40 samples and then get 10,000 sequences per one run. The average length now is 207 base pairs, so it's not as much information as you can get by conventional sequencing, but it's enough to learn quite a bit. And I know from the company that by next summer they will be able to get at least 400 base pair length, which will be sufficient to get to the species level. It's less than 5 cents per sequence compared to the current technology, which is about $5 per sequence. So it's easy, cheap, fast. But the problem comes not in the sequencing, but in the analysis of data. What are you going to do with an output of 400,000 sequences? Are you going to look at them on a spreadsheet? So this is how we manage the ribosomal database, and so our group that does that then has begun to look at this analysis in an automated way. And so we look at this V4 region here because this is the classification accuracy of different regions. So the higher these peaks, the more accuracy you can get from sequencing those regions. So we go for this region right here to get the best accuracy. So I'll show you just one example of using this sequencing. So this comes from a study that was led by Jimmy Jones at Florida under USAID project on carbon sequestration in Africa and different management techniques that might store more carbon and increase fertility. So these are some of the different treatments here. This is some data. The soil, so this is the normal elephant grass and burning in after the winter season, pigeon pea in the winter season, fertilized maize in the summer season, bare fallow, which is right here, and the forest reserve. This is the organic carbon content of those soils, which he tells me happens very fastly. I mean, in 3 years, the bare fallow will drop this much in organic matter. This is the microbial carbon right here from the chloroform fumigation assay right here. So you can see what the biomass is. So we were interested in knowing how these different treatments then altered the microbial community using this sequencing. This is what we found. So so this is a rarefaction analysis with these sequences clustered at 3% or approximately the genus level. This is the number of sequences, so we're getting 10,000 per sample, and this is the number of different genera. This is the maize soils, the different treatments. This is the native forest soil which is the nearby native forest reserve from which these soils were derived. So it seems like the agricultural practice has actually increased diversity by a substantial amount. This is a comparison of an Iowa corn soil, and this is an aquifer soil from the U.S. as an example of something that you would expect to have less low biomass. This shows the information that you can get from this kind of sequencing. Normally with the old sequencing, we would get maybe 50 or 100 sequences and be right down here to analyze for the community. Then we can go within these sequences and look at different microbial groups and ask how they are patterned with treatment. So here's bradyrhizobium, for example, Burkholderia, which I'll talk more about, also a nitrogen fixer. Streptomyces, the source of many antibiotics, Sphingomonas, and alpha proteobacteria. This is the elephant grass treatment, the pigeon pea treatment, the bare fallow. This is the fertilized grass fallow. This is the native forest, and surprisingly has a huge number of bradyrhizobium types. And at the end is the Iowa soil over here for comparison. So it shows how you can go within this data and ask information about particular groups of organisms. And then we can ask more about what is the estimated richness, in other words, how many different types are there? And this is for elephant grass, pigeon pea, bare fallow, the fertilized soil, forest reserve, and here's Iowa over here at the end. So that's an example of what will be coming down the road with the new approach to sequencing. And I would say in 2 years from now at this meeting, I would expect a lot of this kind of information to be available, and learning much more about microbes and habitats and how they respond to different treatments. Now a little bit about genomic comparisons of organisms, because the question is, what are different in these organisms? And how do those differences relate to function and to the organism's success in the particular environment? So before, well, we might do this with the classical techniques or one sequence like the 16S sequence or some other functional gene. Now we can do it with a whole genome. So what we do then is compare one genome against another genome in the database for all genes. And this is our criteria, 60% identity of sequence over 70% of the length. And that's known by protein biologists to represent same general function. Still, a lot of diversity is covered within that variation, but same general function. If it's an esterase, it's probably an esterase. That allows us to get conserved genes. And here we can then take those conserved genes and calculate average nucleotide identity over all of those genes in common. And we use that as the measure of evolutionary distance, relationship between organisms. So this is a summary of a lot of information of all related to A and I on the bottom axis, and all published in different locations. So starting here, the current species standard, the official species standard for a microbe, is if it has, if you take its two DNAs, mix them together, and 70% hybridize. That's a species, if it's that or above. That corresponds to 95% average nucleotide identity. So that becomes a consistent marker. Over here, then we relate that to the whole genome linkage distance. So we take all of those sequences and we determine the best relationships among them. That is the best indication of the true evolutionary relatedness of organisms, because it's all the genes in common. And so you see that this forms a very consistent line here. So it supports then that this A and I really is reflecting evolutionary distance. In the lower right-hand corner, which I'll say more about in a moment, this is how that A and I relates to common gene content, which is what we're going to know about. If we say an organism is a Pseudomonas fluorescens, does it have the same phenotype? Meaning, it's got to have similar genes to have the same phenotype. Okay, so here is that figure I just showed you. There's a relationship here. But what I'm worried about is this right-hand side within the species, because there's a lot of variation within the species. So if we blow that up and do the relationship of A and I to conserved genes, you see the relationship is poor. Now, there are two sets of data on here. This lower line and the solid dots are all of the genes. The upper line and the open symbols are for only the genes that are in the protein database and not associated with mobile elements. So genes that might really be more important to the organism. But you can see the relationship's poor in both cases. So if you look at that more closely, we have organisms the same evolutionary distance, but very different in gene content. And it suggests that they're organisms that's reflecting different ecologies, living in different habitats, or perhaps they're specialized for particular habitats that we don't yet recognize. So in here, for example, we have E. coli. So we would suggest that what we now call E. coli really probably is several species, maybe adapted to several habitats. And I expect some of them are going to be natural environment habitats, not the gut. Then up here, we have sets of organisms which have a much greater evolutionary distance and but still have the same genes. Something's forcing them to keep the same genes. They're still evolving at the nucleotide level, but they're keeping all of the same genes. What are those? Well, they're actually all pathogens. Here's Xylella, which is a pathogen, a leaf pathogen of different plants. But because of its specialized niche in leaves of different plants, it's keeping mostly the same genes to live in that situation. Maybe a little different one for grape and a different one for almond or something like that. But basically same genes. Here's another one that's of personal interest, not me, but well, maybe, to us. Helicobacter. That's the one that lives in your stomach. And that's the one found to cause ulcers. And the one that led to the Nobel Prize 2 years ago in biology. The Australians who found this organism as the cause of ulcers. This organism is very conserved in terms of its gene content, but it's evolved a lot. And it's because its niche is very specialized. It only lives in the stomach, especially of humans. So the concluding point here is that there's substantial gene diversity at the subspecies level within a species, and that ecology appears to be an important factor in the conserved gene core. And thus, definitions based solely on evolutionary distance are problematic. So just like for higher organism species, where ecology is important, it's also important for microbes, though it hasn't been recognized as such until now. So ecology is important, or the niche that the organism lives in. Now, if we take one of the best-known organism, E. coli, and at this time we did this, there were some 20 E. coli genomes sequenced. And we ask how similar those organisms are. We take one of them as the base, and we ask for the next one, which genes are in common. And that's why this line goes down. So as you add each new genome and ask for all the genes to be in common, they decrease. All in common but one, or all common but two. So it says that E. coli, which has about 5,000 megabases or genes also, has a core of 2,500 or 3,000 genes. The others can vary. So there can be a lot of variation in a species. If we go down here and then add up all the new genes found in each new genome sequence, it's about 300 genes per new genome. So what is E. coli? It's varying a lot genetically. Now that doesn't happen for higher organisms. So now that's now called the pangenome. And all in these 20 genomes, E. coli has already explored 16,000 genes. Humans only have 25,000. So probably in the end, E. coli will have as many, what we call E. coli will have as many genes as humans. But I also want to point out here, every one of these genomes sequenced except one, K12, is a pathogen. So the sampling set is extremely biased. It's only pathogens. But we now have just recently sequenced two environmental genomes of E. coli. So we're interested in whether the environmental set will actually look different than these pathogens. But that's to give you an idea of the genetic diversity within what we call a species. So when somebody says, Rhizobium melaloti, well, what is it at the genome level? It can vary. It could vary a lot. So that was average nucleotide identity. So we convert the nucleotides to amino acids and do the same thing. Why do we do that? We do that because we can get greater evolutionary distances. And if we do that and make a phylogenetic tree, we get what you see here. So if you look here, you see bacteria. At the bottom, you see archaea. And here you see eukaryotes. And if you look, I probably can't see it, but when the eukaryotes were there, Homo sapiens, and we're very closely related to a rat. This is our evolutionary distance with rat, and this is mouse. So, but if you look at all the microbes, you see these branching ports are much, much deeper than within the eukaryotes. So at the protein level, what this says is at the protein level, the microbial world is hugely diverse, much, much more diverse than mammals, for example, living mammals. Interestingly, all phyla and several classes are as deep branching as their archaea. And as many of you know, archaea are considered the third division of life, along with the eukaryotes and the prokaryotes. Archaea are the three big branches. But this says at the protein level, all the phyla and several classes are as deep branching as that. So diversity is extremely high. A lot yet to be served. So what's the take home at this particular point? Point I'll make here is that the species level, greater than 70% of genes in common. Some cases high, some cases not so high, but that's a lot of diversity within a species. At genus, only 20 to 40% genes in common. So genus, at best, is weakly predictive of phenotype. It certainly reflects evolutionary distance, but in term as predictive power of what it actually does and where it lives, it can be pretty weak. It only has 20 to 40% genes in common. Family and above are really very interesting for other than evolutionary relationships. They're not predictive of function. 16S, this remains a wonder phylogenetic tool because it has nearly universal primers, the large database, it's reliable, but used for genus and above. Not good for species. So that's at that point. Now I want to talk about three groups of organisms just to give some examples. One that we're interested in Burkholderia. We call it a versophile because it lives lots of places. Its best known habitat is the rhizosphere of grassy plants. Again, other places in soil turfs. But if you want to find a Burkholderia, go to a grassy plant. But some also live in streams and water. Unfortunately, it also colonizes lungs in cystic fibrosis patients, and it's usually lethal in that environment. Some of the Burkholderia also pathogens on plants. In fact, the very first Burkholderia classified is a pathogen of onion, causing soft rot of onion. But some are biocontrol agents for disease, root disease. So it can do both sides, cause disease, prevent disease. Three Burkholderia were weaponized in World War I, so they're biothreat agents. Now it's known that some of them can live intracellularly in fungi, causing fungi to be more toxic, in insects, in plants, in amoeba. So it both can live within cells, within various hosts, as well as free living. It can do a lot. That's why we call it a versatile. It has among the largest bacterial genomes. And actually, humans only have about twice the number of genes that a Burkholderia has. So it's really got them packed in there. It's among the best pollutant degraders, and that's how we got started on it. It's the best known PCB degrader, the best chlorinated solvent co-oxidizer. They grow in a lot of different carbon compounds. And they're well known for aromatic degradation. It wasn't recognized previously, But now, most fixed nitrogen. In fact, our survey of soil isolates 95% of the Burkholderi from soil fixed nitrogen. They also nodulate legumes. And I'm told by Brazilian scientists that if you grow a common bean in the Cerrado region of Brazil, 70% of the nodules will be Burkholderi only. Now, you were taught, right, that rhizobium form nodules on legumes. Okay, you learned something new today, that Burkholderia can as well. And in fact, in Brazil, I think there are three Burkholderia strains that are approved as inoculants for legumes. So it does a lot. It doesn't yet photosynthesize, it doesn't grow by lithotrophy, and it doesn't do well without oxygen. So I want to illustrate with the Burkholderia genomes how one tries to understand how particular genes contribute to success in particular environments. So this is the phylogenetic tree of Burkholderia. This is what is known as the Burkholderia sepacea complex, which is well studied because that's what the medical people study, because that's what the problem in cystic fibrosis patients. All of these strains have been found in cystic fibrosis patients. But particularly Burkholderia sinosepacea, this group right here, is the most common in CF patients. There are three genomes sequenced from those. This is the epidemic strain in the UK and Northeast Canada. This is the epidemic strain in the Mid-Atlantic of the US. And this is the epidemic strain in the Midwest. That's how they're known by the medical people. When CF patients get these, it's really problematic. These are two soil strains that are sequenced also. So the idea here is to take a pathogen and take a soil-adapted strain and learn from its genome what is different about these organisms. Now, first a bit about the Burkholderia genome. It actually has three chromosomes. One we call the core genome, and one we call the lifestyle, and the one we call the individuality replicon. Now, the colors here are whether that gene is common in the next most closely related Burkholderia that's been sequenced. So the only thing I want you to see here is the colors different between these circles. That's why we call this the core genome, because these genes are conserved throughout the genus and into Rostonia, the next closely related organism, which is also has important plant pathogens in it. So this is the motor in the chassis, I would say, that it's conserved. This is the lifestyle. So you can see not a lot of conservation here. So this varies with organisms from different habitats. This is the individuality replicon. This varies, can vary completely within a species. And this is a fairly big. Some microbes have genomes this size. So it's a lot of genes. So this points out, if you call Xenoborans a species, how do you know what it does? Because this one is changing entirely. So this happens to be the best PCB degrader. Only this one isolate of this group degrades PCBs, because that gene is on this individuality replicon and happens to be only in this one species. So knowing if you have a species is not predictive of phenotype. This is information about these different chromosomes and the smallest chromosome. And this is from DNA-DNA hybridization. But the point here is if it's yellow, that means the gene's in common. If it's blue, it's missing. And down here are insertion sequences. So what's happened here is that in the chromosome 1, which I said is very stable without the group, but it's pockmarked by genes going in and out over evolutionary time. Chromosome 2, which is the lifestyle, hasn't been around so long in this manner. It's not hit by insertion sequences, and it's more consistent within the species. If you go to this individuality replicon, it's almost completely different with the other two strains. Now, the other two strains, one comes from a coffee plant rhizosphere in Mexico. The other comes from a patient in Gothenburg, Sweden, from the bloodstream of a patient in Gothenburg, Sweden. So habitat's very different, all the same species, but varying a lot in that individual way route. So that's an example of what we can learn at the species level. Now, back to those cenospacious strains. So these are two strains. Actually, the colors have disappeared here. So this is the pathogen site. Two pathogen strains. These are the two soil strains over here. These two are very closely related at the genome level. The clinician cannot distinguish them apart. So what's different about their genes? Well, this one has 54 genes that are unique. This one has 263 genes that are unique. And what often happens in cases like this, pathogens often come from the environment, but when they find a host and become pathogenic, they get rid of the other genes they don't need, so the genome gets smaller. So this could be that kind of trend. It originally came from soil. We don't know whether this actual strain is pathogenic or not, but its very close relative is lost some genes. And these are the kinds of genes that are different within these two. So this is of interest for two reasons. The medical people are interested because it will help pick out which genes which may be virulence factors and therefore targets for drugs and control. But on the opposite side, it helps us pick out what traits then are important for success in this case, the soil environment. So that's a strategy. Now, we can compare these genomes to each other. And if there's a line there, it means same gene, same organization, and these are evolutionarily distant here. But the point is that the chromosome 1 is more conserved, chromosome 2, and the megaplasmid is getting very different as you do these comparisons. And then this is the pathogen. It's red here. That means pathogenic, and this is supposed to be brown for soil. So these two closely related strains, they're very similar. One huge piece has moved from chromosome 1 to chromosome 2 in this place. In this case, the largest segment yet found in genomics to be a move. And then if we ask 98% sequence identity, 100% sequence identity, still a lot of similarity. So that half of the genome between these two at the sequence level is identical. So that illustrates then what one can do with genomics to better understand the microbes that live in different habitats. And then I'll finish by talking about two redox specialists. One is Schuonella, which I don't know whether you've heard of Schuonella or not, but it is a favorite of DOE. It's one of the DOE model organisms because it's a metal reducer and a radionuclide reducer. And it's best known for living in different redox environments. So these are the kind of environments that it can live in. It can grow aerobically, it can reduce nitrate, it can reduce manganese, it can reduce iron, reduce sulfate. And so it lives in this niche. And I would expect it to be well adapted to most wetland environments. It's also one that produces current. So it's a bioenergy type of organism. But the question then at the genomic level is how does it gain this versatility for living in different redox zones? And within the group, are there specializations so that some live in the higher redox potential, some live in a lower redox potential? So 22 genomes have been now sequenced, and they're not all analyzed. But one habitat for which most information exists comes from the Baltic Sea. And the interest in that environment, well, actually, the Germans have money to study this, so they've collected all the samples. But it's where the redox zone is spread out enough so that you can sample different niches. And so this would show that example here. So here's the oxygen profile. Here's hydrogen sulfide, for example. Here's the nitrogen species. Here's nitrate, nitrite, ammonium. So they have 113 isolates from this zone, different locations in this zone, over 20 years. So it represents a good set of information. And we have then sequenced several organisms from 90 meters, the more oxidized zone, 120 meters, and 140 meters as one gets deeper. So the goal is to understand if there's special redox adaptation that's coded at the genome level. Then we have another set as well, originally done isolated by Ken Nielsen from the Black Sea. So one up here from the oxic zone, and one down here from the anaerobic zone. And if we do the genome comparison, we see there's great similarity, but yet there are some genes that are different in the oxic versus the anaerobic. So it's with this kind of information, same model as pathogen versus soil adaptation. Here it's oxic versus anoxic adaptation. And this then indicates the kind of genes that are different in those groups. Why DOE is interested in this? Well, these organisms reduce uranium, technetium, and chromium, and make them insoluble so they can't move any farther. And they have this problem at the U.S. the Hanford weapons site, in which all of these are moving towards the Columbia River. And the goal is to stop them before they get in the Columbia River. So if these organisms, Shewanella or organisms like them, probably having similar mechanisms, can do this reduction, they can stop them from getting into the Columbia River. So that's the problem, and that's this potential solution. So we can learn a lot then at the molecular level. And what's interesting about Shewanella and Geobacter and Ramixabacter is that they transfer electrons directly to metals. And some of them have these nanowires that can transfer them even to metals more distant away. So strategies to dump electrons in anaerobic systems at something more distant. And understand that at a molecular level so that potentially that can be better optimized. These are where isolates are from around the world. This is the phylogenetic tree. This is then looking then how these are the genes important in metal reduction. Conserved throughout the group, but some of the other genes that may facilitate this process vary throughout the group. Some of these out here are the ones that appear to be important in these nanowires. I'll skip these last two and go to the last set, which is the anaerobic ammonia oxidation. And this afternoon, there will be a talk in the session that led by Jim Prosser, by the Dutch group who has pioneered in understanding the anaerobic oxidation of ammonia, the Animox process. And the reason I wanted to mention it is it's another anaerobe, in this case a fairly newly discovered anaerobe, first recognized actually more than 10 years ago now, but not well studied in freshwater environments. It's now well studied in sewage environments, and in marine environments where it is considered to be very important. So the question is, in wetland, in freshwater wetland environments, how important might this process be? Is there some reason that it can't be important in this environment, or is it because we haven't looked enough yet? So the importance of, so how it contributes to the nitrogen cycle is shown here. I think the interesting thing about it is a completely, well, not say completely, but fundamentally it's a different pathway in biochemistry than was ever known for nitrogen processing before. You know, when we thought 10 years ago that we knew all about all the steps in the nitrogen cycle, here is a nitrogen cycle process completely unrecognized, completely different biochemistry, and turns out to be very important, at least in the marine environment. And it forms, one of its key intermediates is hydrazine, which is solid rocket fuel. What are the Animox bacteria? Well, they belong to the planktomyces, which is illustrated here. Originally, you know, floating marine organisms. A group that's generally very difficult to cultivate. And as the last information I have, that no Animox bacteria have yet been isolated in pure culture. There's a genome sequence known from a highly enriched culture, but none yet have been isolated in pure culture. There are two groups here's the this is the planktomyces. Here is the planktomyces group over here with the different Animox organisms illustrated here. This particular group, they're called candidates if they're not isolated and can't be fully described. So they're candidates to be genera or species. These are found only in marine environments. These groups are in freshwater or wastewater bioreactor environments. They have very interesting biology. They have an anamoxosome, which is the site then of this interesting anaerobic oxidation. They produce some unusual lipids, which become biomarkers, so you can find as a different measure for these organisms in the environment. Some very nice work has been done on fluorescent in situ hybridization to detect these in environments. They typically are in biofilms. This is some work that Ryan Pinton did, who would be a grandson of Bill Patrick, right? Because he worked with Dr. Reddy before he worked with me. In quantitative PCR, relating it to N15 activity measures. And you can see there in these kind of environments, there's a good relationship between quantitative PCR for these organisms and activity as measured by N15. This is distribution of activities with depth because they occur at a particular location. So this is the depth profile into sediment. This is where denitrification and anamox might occur. And this is then some measurements of how important this is at depth in different other environments. This work, and so the references then exist here for these, on all of these particular figures. But this is an important one because it shows the measurement of the particular lipids that are important here, the isotopic measures, what the oxygen profile is, what the nitrate and nitrite profiles are. So they occur at a particular zone in a redox gradient, which is anaerobic, which also has nitrite. So I talked earlier about the 454 flex sequencing, so we did this kind of sequencing at one of these anamox sites in the ocean. All of the sequences we found were of these anamox type that were related to the marine environment. This was from a marine sample. So this is the anamox group here. These are the rest of the planktomyces are found. So I wanted to introduce this anamox process to you so that you were well aware that it could be important in wetland environments, and it certainly needs more study. And I would also encourage you to go to the talk this afternoon by the Dutch group, who are the real experts on this process. Okay, and then in closing, I want to point out this report. This was an NRC report that was issued this spring, the New Science of Metagenomics, Revealing the Sequence of the Microbial Planet. Joe Handelsman and I co-chaired this study group for the National Research Council. And they're funded by NSF, NIH, and DOE to try to identify the path forward in this new scientific field, because we think it's one of the biggest opportunities in science overall for the future. And people who understand microbial communities have microbial communities of interest from a basic discovery point of view, from a functional point of view, can all be a participant in the new science of metagenomics. But it will necessarily draw in people from the computational sciences, for example, and other fields because of the big problem. It's understanding the microbial world. And if you look at this picture closely, this is the sun based on a genome sequence. The trees, the leaves, the ocean, the fish, the roots are all made up of small microbes. So if you look closely, the world as we know it is dependent upon and made up from microbes. So That's what we see as an important future opportunity, is to better understand this unknown microbial world and habitats of importance, and to do this through metagenomics. So I would be happy to, actually, one more slide, which is the people who have done the work that I've talked about. So some important graduate students and postdocs at Michigan State are listed here. We're part of the Shewanella Federation, which includes about a dozen institutions, the Joint Genome Institute and its partners for the sequencing, the ribosomal database team, and the Burkholdt area team, two groups of organisms that I talked about. So I would be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you. Yes.
Jim, that was very exciting to talk. It was quite interesting to see that in forest soil, you have less diversity. And it was kind of doubly interesting to see most of them, they are very resorbent. And I don't know what they are doing there. Now, that raises an important question. And also, you know, other things which you discuss, whether the current taxonomic system is still relevant.
Okay, so I would point out that, yes, in the forest, on that particular figure, it was Burkholdt area that dominates. But I only put on those figures some examples. There are other groups, different groups within the Citobacteria that are even much more dominant than Brady Rhizobium. So that was the percentage of the total, and the percentage of the total might have been 4% or something like that for Brady Rhizobium. But still, it's surprising that Brady Rhizobium are dominating in the forest. Now, so my hypothesis is, not from this, but from earlier data, especially work done in Japan, I think that among the Rhizobiaceae, the dominant ecological niche is soil. A few can infect plants. So I would expect what we're finding is the larger Brady Rhizobium group. But what we knew in the past is the ones that infected plants, because that's the ones we could find by isolation. So I think it's just like any other pathogen, that you have its original source, which is the ones that live in its native habitat, often soil, carrying, you know, with its gene complement, some then, in some cases, have adapted to live with other organisms and enter the host. We're biased by finding always the ones in the host. Now, the taxonomic system, is it relevant or not? And is species relevant or not? I mean, one can discuss this forever. But the important point is, we need some way to communicate and put in categories that we study this, this, and this. And by history, we're forced to use the Linnaeus system. But we can have other systems too. But we do need some way to communicate, some way to record our knowledge. Peter.
So can we talk about that, this species a little bit?
Yeah.
The diverse file, I'm sorry to fall off the species, but if we're calling something that's living in the lungs of humans, and there's something that's fixing nitrogen and soybeans in Brazil and not, and then living in the soil, that's all the same species?
No. Same genus.
Same genus, okay. Same genus. So, but there's a way, I thought it was a bit of a way out of that. So, these versatiles, is this mechanism for versatility very common, where you have a core gene and then you individualize the plasma that you can make? And is that kind of a general mechanism that would allow?
Basically,
calling all those the same genes.
Yeah. So, I think it may be. I think we don't have enough examples yet. One thing I didn't say is the way we look at that core genome, I did say that this was the motor and the chassis. The rest is a breadboard to explore. And it does look to us like those genes are turning over faster than in some organisms. So that could be an overall strategy. You know, some organisms have the motor and the chassis, and they keep that together. But then they have all this other capacity, other strategies or other capacities to explore adaption to different niches. Some of them can do it faster than others. in Burkhold area, and that may be how it gets in all of these different environments.
How many microbes have multiple chromosomes?
I don't know. There's certainly some of importance. Like another important environmental organism in this class is Rhodococcus, a gram-positive. It has a large chromosome, but then it has a bunch of linear chromosomes that are extra. And so linear chromosomes are a completely different strategy, but the same overall idea. It also has large genomes. It also tends to live in the same types of environments, degrade aromatic compounds. Prokaryotes have been around 3.5, 3.8 billion years. So they've had a lot of time to explore different strategies. And I think what we're beginning to see now is some of those different strategies. And we have this tendency, you know, if we know E. coli, well, that's the whole microbial world. But how can it be over 3.8 billion years? There's a lot of different solutions. Some things that are known about that in Shewanella. We haven't particularly worked on that particular point, but it has similar mechanisms to Geobacter, which does use humic materials as terminal electron acceptors. So I can't remember whether somebody's done that with some of the Shewanella or not, but I would expect it to be the case. I mean, its strategy is to be able to dump electrons to something out there and get ahead. So if you can dump it to organic matter, why not?
Could you comment on competition between phenols, phosphates, and hemlocks in wet environments?
Sorry, I didn't catch the first part of that. What?
Could you comment on competition between phenols, phosphates,
I think because the requirements are a little bit different. You would have to have nitrite for anammox and ammonia for the oxidation. So what has been done is measurement of N15, N2 produced by the isotope pairing approach, which would then rule, you could then distinguish between anammox and denitrification. In the marine environments where anammox is significant, it ranges somewhere around either 25 to 40% or so of the N2 is from that. Ryan, are you still here? What? Okay, so ready. Yeah, well, did I say that right? Reddy says I did. Ryan, do you say that's
79%.
Up to 79% can be. Yeah. Okay, so that's all I can say about that right now. Yes, that's right. For these large genome organisms, while I gave the impression earlier that all these other genes are to explore opportunities, but certainly some of those are providing functions that we don't know about that are probably beneficial. So certainly there's a lot of opportunity in those other genes to do something beneficial for plants. That we don't know about. So, yeah. A lot to be mined there.
Yes, this Burkholderia is, again, very interesting organism. Now, if you kind of use this as a nitrogen fixer, and somehow then pathogenicity genes an activity that could be a problem.
Could be. Right. Now, in the case of the, actually certainly in the case of cystic fibrosis, the medical people don't really understand, from my perspective, what are the virulence factors. And they don't have an animal model. So that's why we can't take the soil strain, for example, and put it in an animal model and test pathogenicity. They don't have an animal model. And the genes that they, there's one set of genes that were found in this first sequence strain, the Cabopillus gene set, that were considered to be, a big virulence factor gene. You know, when we did the second genome of the mid-Atlantic strain, it's not there at all. So, and some of the medical people I deal with, their view is, you know, there may be 25 genes in the Burkholderia area that are important pathogenesis. None may be absolutely essential in any particular case, but it may be a suite of 6, 12 or so that in combination make it a pathogen. That makes it much harder to figure out than, you know, if there was a toxin or some very direct virulence factor. And some of the, there's some work going on to try to see if these relate to the plant pathogenicity, especially an onion, since that's a good model. Are there similarities that might occur between the plant pathogenesis and the human pathogenesis?
From my perspective, the trying to couple the codal diversity to interesting biochemical function has been pretty unsatisfying.
Is what?
It's been unsatisfying. It's difficult to do. And I'm wondering, from your perspective and techniques, whether we're any closer to that and where a biochemist might look to make those sorts of things.
Okay, so what I expect down the road in something that would directly relate to that is genes that are important in the kinetic properties that relate to concentrations like KM values, for example, and turnover numbers. So down the road I can see families of functional genes in which we know something about the KM and turnover values for those that correspond to sequence. And then we could have molecular tools for those different sequences that would allow us then directly relate to function in the habitat. So, but I think we're a ways off from doing that. Now, one thing I didn't talk about is that we have also a functional gene database, fun gene database. And we have it for N-cycle genes, for example, and biodegradation genes. And it's based on a hidden Markov model search of GenBank every month. So it's updated every month. And then it gives you scores then of how these sequences relate to the model sequences put in. I think that eventually will be useful in this regard, because then we can use that to begin to update related to whatever, to function, to habitat, or something like that. And it also provides a tool for primers, for testing primers against those particular sets. So that's the direction I see that could be useful in that regard. There could be others, but that's the one that I think is the most directly related.
We have exploring that question a little bit. When you put this, maybe a tool that we might isolate some insights on plant areas, we have these pockets of this we have. For some reason, we have a cancer area. If you looked at it every way in the world, trying to find out why people in this part of the earth have these diseases inexplicably. But your thing about organisms here living
Oh, yes. I mentioned the metagenomics at the end. NIH has jumped that on that as one of their roadmap projects. So there will be significant new money from NIH in metagenomics roadmap. They have identified several human habitats, you know, like the tooth, the gut, the skin, I don't remember, five habitats, to look more extensively at the microbes that colonize us. Now, that is directly related to us, but the extension of that is then how it relates to the environment around us, too, and the foods in those environments that we eat. So the decade goal would be to understand something about patterns of microbes and genes as they relate to particular ecological features. Because that's the start then of the fundamental understanding of why that pattern exists and can that pattern be managed. From Costa Rica, Anna. Right.
We need the enzymatic profile for the microbiome of the caterpillar. So it needs more or less the same species comparing same species from human isolation. And same species human isolation, the rate of enzymatic activity is diminished to minimum compared to the ones that are coming from caterpillar. And it's basically because they don't need that.
Right.
Basically, using processed material in the human environment, whereas in the wild, they are really growing.
Yeah, that makes good sense to me, right, because they've adapted to their new niche.